Right. Thank you. Hi, I'm Barrett Wessel. I'm a PhD student at the University of Maryland with Marty Ravenhorst. I'm going to talk a little bit about the soil-landscape relationships in the Road River bathyscape of Chesapeake Bay. And first, it's important, I guess, to describe the Road River and the Chesapeake Bay just a little bit. Chesapeake Bay is the biggest estuary in the United States. There's baygrass, oysters, crabs, major fishery, major part of the environment and the economy of the state of Maryland. Road River is a sub-estuary on the western side of Chesapeake Bay. It's about 1,000 acres. There is an existing sediment map of it. That's what you see here. This one's about 2 years old. There's a slightly updated version. It's not much better. As you can see, this doesn't really hold a candle to a soil map, right? There's four categories in here: mud, sand, a complex between the two, and some shell reef that's incorrectly mapped on there from what we've seen. And so this map is really unsuitable for recent aquaculture programs in the state of Maryland that allow watermen to lease areas of the bay bottom to plant oysters and clams and have the exclusive right to manage and harvest from those spots. And so we partnered with the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center, which is located right where that star is, and so they do a lot of fisheries research in this area, and they were interested in having a higher quality map as well. And we worked with them to develop this proposal and these objectives to delineate landforms from bathymetric maps, to select transects and describe soil cores across those landforms throughout this landscape, and to develop pedogenic models for Chesapeake Bay that we could use to map this sub-estuary and to map similar sub-estuaries throughout the region, since there's quite a few of these throughout the bay. And so we started with some point data from 1933 and 1972 from the National Ocean Service. They've done 150 years worth of surveys on all the coasts of the United States, and those just happen to be the 2 years that are available for the bay, or this part of it. And we conducted our own survey in 2015 with a Garmin Echo Sounder GPS. You can see some of the contour data here. We compared all these and found remarkable stability. There's not a lot of change in the landforms in the bottom, maybe a foot or so in a few spots, but the landforms themselves are pretty much all there. You can see, does the mouse work here? Does it? There it is. Okay. You can see that there's this shelf that runs along much of the outside of the Road River, and then there's the central channel. Most of it's this flat central channel, but the shelf really comes up, and it's consistent throughout much of the landscape there. And on this side, you see the DEM, and the red dots are some of our points, just a different way to present that data. And so we delineated these landforms. 11 different landform types were identified. We started with the landform surrounding the water and worked our way in. So we looked at adjacent landforms, the water depth, the three-dimensional shape. Are we looking at flat things, concave, convex surfaces, and the slope and the aspect? The aspect is pretty important, which direction these things face, because that influences how much wave energy and therefore how much truncation or how much sand delivery there might be. We took cores in a variety of different methods. We used a Macaulay auger. That's the first picture here. It's a half cylinder with a plate of metal on it. You stick it into soft materials. It works well in soft fluid muds and organic soils, histosols, and you can turn it and it cuts a half core and you pull it out and you get this nice half cylinder. We used a traditional bucket auger, so in hard consolidated materials, as long as you can weigh it out there, you can stand and auger between your feet and pass it up to somebody on the boat who can lay it out on a table bit by bit. And we used a vibra core, which is this remarkable method to get really great cores. It's pretty simple. It's actually a concrete vibrator they use to shake air bubbles out of freshly poured concrete, but you can bolt that to the top of a piece of aluminum irrigation pipe. The vibrations travel through the pipe. You can lower it through a hatch on the deck of your boat, and it liquefies unconsolidated material right at the tip, just knocks it out of the way, and you get these cores easily 2 to 4 meters, and then just pull it up once you get the top of it. We did a variety of analyses. We did this in a traditional soil science way. We horizonated using the Schoenberger book. We did color, odor, field texture. We did some stuff in the lab, particle size analysis, electrical conductivity. We also conducted moist aerobic incubations. This was one of the most important parts of the study that the NRCS was interested in, and that's seeing how much acidity is going to be produced by these samples, what the pH is going to end up as over time. So you take a little bit, you put it in a cup, you measure the pH, and then you just let it oxidize over time, 8 to 16 weeks. And any pyrite that's in there is going to oxidize to form sulfuric acid, which will react with carbonates and the clays in there. And so the pyrite isn't the only important part. But the good thing about this is it gives you sort of an integrated measurement. And we have two types of materials: hypersulfitic, that's if the pH drops below 4, and hyposulfitic, that's if the pH drops but doesn't get below 4. That's in the Australian classification. It's in WRB. It's not in soil taxonomy yet, but we hope to see that change made. And then we described redox features, which is where we really ran into surprises in these subaqueous materials. You might not have expected that. So We've got all our pH data. I'm just going to walk you through one of these. pH on this side. We got our timeline here and all our different horizons, and you can see the pH dropping on those. And so let's start all the way up in the top here of the tidal creeks. We've got submerged and buried marsh surface soils walking through an idealized transect of this landscape. These key out as sapric sulfi-wasists. That's histosols. They're underwater. That's the wasist and sulfi. They've got materials in there that are hypersulfitic, and you can see from the pH graph some of these pHs dropped below 3. Orthaptohistic subgroups of other soils, which means buried O-horizons. These represent sequences of marsh accretion. These are really complex profiles. There's a lot going on representing sea level changes and various discontinuities in there. And the hypersulfitic materials are really concentrated in and around buried A and O horizons. That organic matter source is really important in the accumulation of pyrite. Moving into just slightly deeper water, that shelf we saw in the contour data, this is the submerged platform. You can see the data here. Some of the pH drops doesn't really get below 5.5 though. These are typic fluviwasents. That name doesn't really tell us anything. It's not a good name for these. It's just where they key out because taxonomy doesn't capture what's going on in this type of a profile yet. Now what we see here are scour lag sandy textures over these truncated submerged paleosols. Sands over sandy clays and sandy clay loams. This really neat, really sharp, abrupt discontinuity. And if you keep going through this, you eventually get into an unoxidized zone. And we know that these are paleosols because they've got iron oxides. They're consolidated, and they've got jarosite, this pale yellow mineral which only forms as a result of pyrite oxidation at low pH, and you have to be in an oxidizing environment for that to happen. Then we've got the wave-built terraces next to that, so you move from the platform to just slightly deeper water. These are the landforms that are built by the deposition of the sand that's cut from the wave-cut platform. And so that material is cut. And then as soon as it's carried into deeper water, the coarser materials fall out. And so you end up with samowasents, just sandy subaqueous soils, or fluviwasents. That's if some finer materials are mixed in there. These are non-fluid sands and loamy sands, generally hyposulfitic, again hypersulfitic, in and around the buried A and O horizons. And then in the deep water, the main part of the area here, the estuarine channel and tidal creek soils. You can see the pH drops on these, but it doesn't drop very far. These are Grosic hydro wasents. Wasent, again, subaqueous soil. Hydro, it's fluid. If you take a handful of it, you can squeeze it through your fingers. And Grosic just means that you've got a thick layer of that type of material. And so it's almost all moderately to highly fluid. Silty clays, silty clay loams, acidifies, but not hypersulfitic. This was a big surprise because everybody expected this material to be this hypersulfitic bad stuff that if you dredge it and put it on the landscape, it's going to produce a great deal of acidity. But it seems to be buffered or have some neutralization potential in there that doesn't make it that concerning, still somewhat concerning. And so with all that data, we can put together our soil landscape model and walk through the timeline of the development of this landscape. And so we're going to go from A to F here. Looking at A, this takes us back 30 to 60 million years. There was an ocean over the area. This was a deep ocean environment, and we had the accumulation of glauconite, glauconitic material, as fecal pellets from marine organisms, and pyrite, represented by the black dots in there. And this created the Aquia and the Nanchamoy geologic formations, which we see along much of the coastal plain. Moving to B, sea level rises a little more time passes. We get the Miocene formations deposited on top of that, perhaps Quaternary formations. Between B and C, I'm sort of simplifying a little bit because there was actually a lot of sea level change during this period, and there may have been various cutting and deposition and cutting and deposition events. But overall, we get to see where we've cut down to the Nanchamoy formation. And you can see that that green glauconitic material has oxidized. We've got the brown colors. We have the formation of iron oxides and jarosite. We have a regular subaerial A horizon there, high in organic matter. We do still find root traces in some of these where the buried A's are preserved. And plants, it supported plants at the time. And at some depth, you get into an unoxidized zone where you can still find the dark colors, the original marine sediment type glauconite, and a lot of pyrite in there. And that's generally hypersulfitic material that's ready to acidify if disturbed. But the overlying material has had most of that, all of it really, removed during that period of time. Moving to D, sea levels come back up. We've all been to a shoreline and seen a cliff or a nick point or something, and that's what happens here. We get truncation. The high energy waves hit the shore. They cut off that overlying material and truncate. And so we think when we see these paleosols, we're probably seeing deep subsolum. This is probably stuff that's meters down. And when you core around the other parts of Maryland, you can see that several meters down, maybe 5 to 8 meters in some areas. So that's truncated. We get the beginnings of the formation of our landforms then, our submerged wave cut platform and our submerged wave built terrace, where that sand is just moved into the deeper water next to it and drops out. Moving to E there, sea level rise a little bit more as the Nick Point migrates more into the landscape. This area gets a little deeper. You get sands deposited over that. So now you've got the scour lag deposit over the truncated paleosol. The wave-built terrace builds more. And now that you've got really deep water in the coves and the estuarine channel, several meters, 2 to 4 meters today in most spots in there, you get these fine silting materials, the Grosic hydrowascents, forming as those finer materials fall out. And you get a subaqueous A horizon, where we have the accumulation of monosulfitic materials or metastable iron sulfides, depending on who you talk to. But these are really reactive iron sulfide materials. And then on to F, we have more time that's passed. The water is a little bit deeper. The more time that passes, you get this sort of reduction front that seems to grow, to advance into the oxidized tertiary material. And so as organic matter diffuses down there, those iron oxides are reduced, and you can see a glade layer in the top of this, and then sort of another abrupt boundary with the material that still has the iron oxides in the brown colors. The wave-built terraces grow, the fine silty deposits get very thick. The deepest we've been able to core them is 5 meters, and in the center we can't get past that. And so we don't know how deep it is, but it's quite a deposit of these fine materials. And you see on F here we have numbers 1, 2, and 3. Just above that we have the inset contour map, 1, 2, and 3, and that's really the transect right across there. We have the submerged wave cut platform in the shallow water. You can stand on this. The submerged wave-built terrace right next to that. You core through that. You find a lot of sands at a certain depth. You do sometimes find the platform. And then the fine silty material past that, and that's in the cove, and that dominates the coves and the estuarine channel parts of this landscape. And with that, and with our core data and the bathymetric data, we're able to produce a better map of the soils. And that's what we've got here. This is sort of the draft map we've sent to the NRCS now. We've developed 7 new soil series. These are proposed series. We could probably do another 7 fairly easily. It's easy to find series. Any core that's slightly different could be another one. We've got 15 different map units, map unit types here, and 57 individual delineations, 57 polygons on here. The map units are named for the dominant series. Of course, we've got other series in there, and that's the first 2 letters. And then the 3rd letter is the depth phase. Rather than looking at a slope phase or something that would be more useful in the subaerial environment, depth is more useful here because that's telling the watermen what sort of equipment they'll need if they're going to try to work that part of the bottom. And so our conclusions are that the subaqueous soils in the Road River, they correlate well with landform position. And this tells us that the soil landscape paradigm that's been used for over a century to map soils throughout the subaerial landscape also applies here in this subaqueous setting. And if you understand the relationships there, you can map the landscape and without any cores, map the soils. You can just go back and do some ground truthing once you understand that model and those relationships. And so our next step is going to be to take this model, to do that in an adjacent sub-estuary to produce that map and to test it with ground truthing. And I'm fairly confident that we're going to be pretty close. And so these subaqueous soil maps, they provide valuable guidance to inform site selection, on-site evaluations, and land management decisions for aquaculturists and others, people doing marine construction, people doing dredging, the Army Corps, people doing fisheries research, all sorts of folks who use the marine environment can benefit from this type of information. And so with that, I'd like to acknowledge all these people. I don't have time to list them, but my committee, the people who helped me on the boat, random folks at NOAA. I asked about tide data because that's well outside of what a soil scientist usually does. And, of course, thanks to the NRCS and the National Science Foundation for funding. And with that, I'll take any questions. Sure, yeah. So the question is, what happens to the acidity that forms in those oxidized tertiary materials? And we still see it to some extent. In a few of those spots, it's not radically low. It's not 3 or 4, but it's still 4 to 5 in some spots out there. And so some of it is still residual, but a lot of it gets flushed out by interaction with the seawater. The seawater's got a pH of 8.2, and so just the flushing action over the course of the really at least 10,000 years that's been submerged through this cycle of sea level rise, we think is enough to neutralize that.
All right. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you.